When federal agencies make financial grants to science and technology researchers, scouring their proposals for possible conflicts of interest is a big part of that process. But some agencies are focused on financial conflicts and less on guarding against the risks of new scientific discoveries being sent to potential foreign adversaries. That appears to be the case with the National Institutes of Health. That's according to the Government Accountability Office. For more, Federal News Network's Jared Serbu spoke with the Acting Director for Science, Technology, and Assessment and Analytics at the GAO, Candace Wright.
NIH has had a longstanding conflict of interest policy, which we think is certainly a great starting point. Our concern with NIH was specifically that its policy, while it called for grantees to disclose all financial interests, it didn't specify both foreign and domestic. And we think that specifying those things are really important to making sure that grantees are aware and the universities are aware of all of the types of information that that needs to be disclosed. And so, we made a recommendation to NIH that it really needed to update its policy, particularly its conflict of interest policy, to ensure that grantees are aware to disclose both financial as well as non-financial conflicts, and then also emphasizing, foreign and domestic interests. Since our report issued in December 2020, when we made that recommendation, NIH has taken steps to update certain applications and forms to have grantees more fully disclose non-financial interests, including foreign activities and resources. But we also think that they should take the next step of updating their conflict of interest policies as well.
Yeah, as I understand it, NIH's position on this, at least initially, was that, look, we're already requiring everybody and telling them they must disclose all conflicts of interest, which in their view would include foreign and domestic. Maybe say a few more words about why GAO thinks that's not adequate.
Right. So at the time when NIH first developed its policies, there was a great emphasis on domestic interests. However, concerns around foreign influence in federally funded research has continued to grow over the last few years, especially as there's greater international collaboration. So we think it's really important that given the changing circumstances, that the policies and the requirements explicitly define what it is that needs to be disclosed so that there isn't any question. So yes, one might think that it's certainly plausible and understandable that when you say disclose all interests, that would include both foreign and domestic. We just think that given the current environment where there is this great concern and increasing concern about foreign influence in federally funded research, that it doesn't hurt to take that added step to explicitly state what the issues are so that all involved in the research community, are clear about what needs to be addressed and what the concerns might be.
And NIH certainly is not blind to these risks. As you pointed out in your testimony last week, I believe, you characterized their position as being aware that there is, quote, a systematic failure to disclose by participants in certain foreign talent recruitment programs. Those programs, I think, are a subset of the overall potential for foreign influence. But can you say a little bit about what those programs are and why they're a particular threat here?
Yeah, so this is something that has come up quite a bit and has been widely reported. At GAO, we haven't looked explicitly at these foreign talent recruitment programs, but certainly throughout the course of our work, heard a great deal of concern about them. For example, the Office of Science and Technology Policy has reported on this and noted that these programs, certainly a number of them do exist for legitimate purposes to aid other countries in recruiting science and technology experts in certain fields. However, there are some countries that are using these programs as a way to get access to U.S. research by having people participating in these programs and providing them salaries and other benefits in exchange for sharing information about what they're learning through participation in various U.S. research efforts. And so these countries might be using these programs and researchers who are participating in these foreign talent recruitment programs to be able to divert information that is coming from the research that they might be involved in, diverting intellectual property, diverting knowledge and other kinds of things like that, that could then serve to undermine the integrity of U.S.-funded research. We've also seen in past years, or I should say heard in past years, that there's been, a great deal of interest for researchers to participate in these kinds of programs. They have been in the past considered to be prestigious, but now certainly with more awareness that these programs could be used to divert U.S. research, there's a little bit more concern making sure that we have, better awareness about these programs and who may be participating in them. I will say that just participating in the program in and of itself may not be problematic, but it's important that information be disclosed so that the universities and agencies funding these research, have the full awareness of people's involvement, their affiliations, so that they can make decisions about, whether, the researcher should go forward given some of these kinds of affiliations with foreign talent recruitment programs.
Right. And it seems to me at least one of the issues here is, NIH or any agency can do a perfect job of doing due diligence while it's reviewing grant proposals. But once the check is out the door and the grant has been made, it's sort of up to the universities to do the policing work on this, right? Because they're on the ground and NIH or the grant making agency isn't. So what should NIH be doing to better equip universities to be those eyes and ears and watch out for potentially harmful things going on?
Right. So we certainly found that the NIH relies on the universities to identify any potential financial or non-financial conflicts and to mitigate them. We think that it's really important for the agencies to make the universities aware of, what the current threat environment is, what the potential risks might be, and working with them to be able to identify it. In the course of our work, we actually spoke with a number of principal investigators who lead research at various universities that are receiving grant funding, and a number of them told us that, they weren't certain that they had the tools and the knowledge to be able to identify these kinds of foreign talent recruitment programs, and some of them didn't even know that they existed. So we think that there's certainly a responsibility for the agencies to be making the research community aware of what the threats are and the risks so that they can, be equipped with the appropriate information to help manage those risks.
And last thing before we let you go, Candace, we've focused a lot on NIH here just because that was the focus of your testimony last week. But as you alluded to, this is based on a broader report GAO did late last year where you looked at this issue across several different agencies. Are there agencies that are doing this better than others? Are there best practices that kind of emerged from that work as you looked across the government?
So we actually looked at the Departments of Defense and Energy, as well as NASA, NSF, and NIH for the report that was issued in December. And by and large, we found that NIH and NSF, were among the agencies that had agency-wide policies, certainly NASA as well. DOD and DOE did not have agency-wide policies, and so as such, we made recommendations that they really think about, developing agency-wide conflict of interest policies to help address this issue. So the agencies really vary. I would certainly say, we thought it was good that NIH, NSF, and NASA all had those agency-wide conflict of interest policies, and we made some recommendations around strengthening those policies, as well as strengthening their efforts to address how to enforce these policies and also how to communicate information to the broader research community so that they are, equipped with the necessary tools and information and resources to help address this issue.
Candace Wright, Acting Director for Science, Technology Assessment and Analytics at the GAO, speaking with Federal News Network's Jared Serbu.
Welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Rick Wade, Senior Vice President of Strategic Alliances and Outreach at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Previously, Rick was a Senior Advisor and Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke. He worked closely with the Obama administration, and he also worked with Commerce's Economic Development Administration to foster regional economic development in distressed areas and with the Minority Business Development Agency to create jobs through the growth of minority-owned businesses. He received a BS from the University of South Carolina and an MPA from Harvard University. Rick, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me.
And thank you so much for having me. Look forward to the conversation.
Rick, in today's environment, leaders have had to adapt and find new ways to lead with transparency and empathy. But can you tell us a bit about how you've adapted your leadership style?
You know, this past year has clearly presented some unique challenges that certainly me, or I as a leader, have had to adapt. You think about a pandemic, for example, that has placed us in probably one of the most challenging circumstances is sort of lead in a virtual world now. I've not been in my office for nearly a year. And the idea that we don't have the human interaction, which I think is very important when you think about the empathy that is a very important value of leadership. So trying to lead from a virtual environment, Shane, and be empathetic and be sensitive to the needs of others has presented a terribly difficult challenge. One of the other defining moments, I think, in our time that has dictated a change in leadership, if you will, was the murder of George Floyd. I think it created a whole different consciousness in America and certainly within me about the importance of being empathetic in the way I lead, to be inclusive, to lead in a way in which you're very sensitive to the impact of your decisions on others across our community. So it certainly has been a challenging year to adapt, but I'm happy to say that I'm still here and we're moving forward.
Perfect. Throughout your career, what have been some pivotal moments or lessons learned that have shaped the leader that you are today?
You know, there have been so many moments, Shane. I grew up in rural South Carolina. Quite honestly, at a time when I saw what legal segregation was. I mean, I wasn't able to go to an integrated school until middle school, being bused across town. And I remember, as strangely as it may sound, in 1979, I wanted to run for vice president of my student body at Lancaster High School, a rural school. And I had to run on the ballot as vice president Black. Literally. And there was another candidate who ran as vice president white. And the irony of that story is that the following year, I ran for president and I won overwhelmingly. That was a lesson for me in leadership. And the lesson there was, you know, perseverance, have the tenacity, have a vision and overcoming barriers. And I didn't let the idea that the construct that I had to run as vice president deter me from reaching my bigger dream, which was to represent students. So I know that's that perhaps may be a small example of leadership, but it really did define how I view myself, the vision that I have, my willingness to fight for change. And that was the beginning. I think that set the foundation of how I lead. And there've been so many other moments. One of the most defining moments for me personally was the massacre at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. A very close friend of mine, Senator Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who lost his life. And it conjured up, again, these issues of how deep the divide in terms of race in America is. But it also inspired me to lead even more and to lead harder and to lead with diligence and vigilance to help close that divide. So there have been so many defining moments in my career. I will tell you, even after the murder of George Floyd and my role at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to galvanize the business community inspired by that tragedy. And now we have a whole broad, historic, sweeping, what we call Equality of Opportunity Initiative that I'm leading, that I was inspired to develop. And we're bringing together corporations from across America to address what we call equality of opportunity. So my point there, I think with all of these moments, they've all been pivotal moments at different parts of my life, my career, my journey. And I've seized those moments to make the best of them, of what I could.
That's fantastic. It's a great, great answer. Many stories. Thank you very much for sharing that. Who is the most impactful leader in your life and what quality did you admire about them?
You know, I can't say that I had just one, but I would tell you the one person who whose historical leadership has inspired me the most. And that is the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And there's so many attributes there that are consistent with my values. But the one part of his leadership was vision. And I mean, the idea that you can have a dream, which we often define and think of his big I Have a Dream speech. But I think that's a really important attribute of leadership, Shane, that you can sort of see beyond the challenges of today and see a better future for people and for yourself. So the idea that leaders have vision despite the challenges, is seeing a forest despite the trees, is seeing an opportunity despite the barriers. And that attribute, I think, is one that I embody. I mean, I'm very optimistic despite the challenges, despite the circumstances. So the whole notion of vision was a very important attribute that I learned and that I've tried to emulate from the leadership of Dr. King.
Wow, fantastic. And as someone who's got an extensive background in federal service and out of federal service, what advice would you give to feds looking to develop leadership skills? And you can talk about mid-career, senior career, early career. What comes to mind there?
Yeah, listen, I mean, you're aware that I had the fortunate opportunity. We didn't have a Secretary of Commerce when President Obama, of course, I served as one of his senior advisors, was inaugurated. And the president asked me to go to the Department of Commerce to hold the fort down. And that was one of the most exciting experiences in my entire career, not just for the title and the wonderful experiences, but I understood the value of federal employees. And folks forget sometimes, Shane, that we political appointees, we come and go. But the folks who are grinding every day, who are at their desk no matter rain, sleet, or snow, who bring innovations but yet don't get the credit for it because the political appointees get all the credit. I think I learned something about the humility of being a leader. And I built so many friends who were federal employees, not just at the manager level, but the frontline workers, the administrative assistants. And I was very deliberate. I mean, one of the things that I was most proud of, strangely enough, I was that guy, even though I was senior advisor to the Secretary of Commerce, and my office was on the floor, at the top floor. We call it the blue carpet, Shane. But I made a deliberate point to go eat in the cafeteria every day, as many days as I could, just to sit down and talk with employees. And I grew from that. And there were so many times where I took their ideas back to the blue carpet and said, and I told the Secretary Locke, you got to go down and sit down and talk with regular, common, everyday folks. They're in the cafeteria, not in the dining room on the blue carpet. And so he started doing that. So the point is, I think for me, the advice that I would give is to continue to do the hard work. I do think that we should do a better job in government in providing the kind of admiration for those workers as we do the high level appointees. And that may be something that I'm looking to work on myself to help continue to advocate for our federal employees. Those are the hard workers. That's where the work gets done. And so I think that's a lesson for me. If there was some advice and counsel I could give, is to continue to do your work. But we have to do our work as leaders of these agencies to create ladders of success and reward and admiration for the hard work that they do.
Rick, thank you very much. You've inspired me. These are tremendous insights and stories. I love every single one of them. You've got a fascinating journey in leadership yourself. And thank you very much for sharing that with us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Thank you for listening to today's Lessons in Leadership podcast. And until we see you next time, take good care.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.